Conversations with Friends is a new series.
A series within a series.
Creative conversations between writer friends.
We were blown away by the calibre of the pitches we received from established, mid-career, debut and emerging writers.
From those writing poetry, fiction, non-fiction, plays, newsletters and PhDs.
Conversations to get you through these strange COVID days and beyond.
Sit back, stay home and enjoy. This episode of Conversations with Friends is with Sarah Schmidt and Favel Parrott. In 2001, Favel Parrott's career was launched with her critically acclaimed debut, Past the Shallows, a heartbreaking novel. It was sold internationally, shortlisted in the prestigious Miles Franklin Award, and won the Dobby Literary Award. Favel herself won the ABA Newcomer of the Year in 2012. Her next novel, When the Night Comes, was also critically acclaimed and further consolidated Favel's reputation with booksellers and readers. Favel's short stories have been published in various journals, including Island, Griffith Review, and Wet Ink. Favel's third novel, There Was Still Love, won the Indie Book Award 2020 Book of the Year and Fiction Book of the Year. It has also been shortlisted for the Stella Prize 2020.
Sarah Schmidt's debut novel, See What I Have Done, was published by Hachette in 2017 and has been reviewed widely in Australia and internationally to critical acclaim. It won the ABA Literary Fiction Book of the Year in 2018 and was the inaugural winner of the Mudd Literary Prize. It was on the long and short list of nearly every bloody prize ever in Australia and worldwide, and the whole list is in our show notes. See What I Have Done was published in the UK and the US and was translated into German, Dutch, French, Italian, Korean, Polish, and Turkish. Sarah's short stories, articles, reviews, and essays have appeared in publications including The Guardian, Sydney Morning Herald, and many more. And Sarah is the Reading and Literacy Coordinator at Yarra Plenty Regional Library and the Artistic Director and Producer of their Book Lovers Festival. When she's not writing, Sarah is an ensemble performer at the Improv Conspiracy Theatre in Melbourne, and her second novel will be published in 2021.
I feel like I've underachieved, Kate.
Oh, these two.
Oh, my God. I can't even pronounce half these awards.
I know.
Unbelievable. And
that's what I mean. Like, Sarah's got this one novel out that won everything ever. And, yeah, I know. Lucky they're really nice.
They are really nice. This is a pretty awesome episode, I have to say. These guys go pretty deep, don't they? And that is exactly what we were after when we set this up.
And I love that also just the difference in tone and the difference in the intimacy between all those different lots of friends that we've had so far is exactly as you say, was exactly what you're looking for. Because if you do, we've all got our own different kind of interview tone. You and I have different ones as well. And so you can get a similar story out of people. Whereas in this way, when friends are talking to each other, it goes in really different directions.
Well, I think they also reference back conversations when you're talking to an old friend. There's so much context to everything that you're saying. But one thing that got me excited was books they read as kids.
Yes.
Kate, were you a Babysitter's Club fan?
Totally, totally was. And even back then, though, I saw it as like it didn't sit on the same shelf as Anne of Green Gables. It was, you know, it was my
What about Sweet Valley? Was that under the bed?
Yeah, a little bit more under the bed. I definitely did that too, out of the library. Were you?
I was. I was a Babysitter's Club fan. I didn't mind it being on the bookshelf. I wasn't a closet fan, but I was gutted to learn, I think at RMIT just a couple of years ago, that Anne M. Martin didn't write all the books.
I know.
Did you know that at the time?
Well, I think that probably I learned it at the same time, and I don't think that we should find out these things about the people that we idolised as young readers.
I think, do you know David Nichols, the author? He writes sort of humorous fiction. I'm pretty sure he was one of the ghostwriters.
Anything funny, Catherine, ever.
That was like a good connection, finding out he was. I really like him. Anyway.
He was one of the ghostwriters.
Very sad. Yeah.
Ah, I do think there's that thing about the idols, though. Have you been listening to Sugar Calling, Cheryl Strayed's new podcast?
No, it's on there and I've downloaded episodes, but not yet.
She rings Judy Blume and talks to Judy Blume. And it's this extraordinary thing. Like, you can hear the fandom in her voice when she's talking to Judy Blume, as I would be.
I have a friend at work. We have instant messenger at work, and whenever we try and message each other and the other person's not responding, we always write, "Are you there, Margaret?"
I love
Are you so there, much. God? It's me, Margaret.
Are you there, God? It's me, Margaret. Yep. I noted, because we take notes about these things, you and I have both picked up exactly the same writing-related advice or moment that Sarah talked about, which was when your ideas are further along than your skill level.
It's brutal. It's so comforting to hear others feel that too.
Yeah, I think so too. And that's what you're striving to do the whole time, just get through that gap.
And the next time you start a little bit better than you were before.
Yeah, yeah. What did you think about the visitations, Catherine?
I really liked the visitations.
Have you been visited?
Not by a muse. Sarah's, I must admit, visitations sound fairly traumatic.
I know.
Yeah, like really traumatic. So yeah. I think maybe that's happens to more literary people, perhaps. I've certainly never had visitations from anything I was writing, but I reckon I did have weird visitations when I was a kid. Yeah, so I loved hearing that conversation.
Yeah, I think that it's beautiful, and them talking about it together, beautiful and scary. I loved that part where Fable talked about dreaming the Nella Dan, which is the boat in When the Night Comes, and that she would wake up in the mornings. She says this so much more beautifully, but she wakes up weeping because the boat is gone. You can feel that when you read her books. You can, I think what they're talking about, that kind of presence in their work, you can feel that in both Sarah and Fable's work, I think.
Yeah, and there's two sides to it, isn't there? There's the beauty of immersion and the inability to be in the moment in life because of that level of immersion. It's both.
Yes. I hope that our listeners are completely immersed in this conversation with Sarah Schmidt and Fable Parrott.
Hello.
Hello. How are you?
I'm good. How are you going, Sarah?
I'm good, Fable.
It's lovely to hear your voice.
You too. How are you going? Really going?
I'm doing a puzzle, so that says a lot. I think I'm going a little bit crazy. But I have
as to be expected.
Backyard, which is helping.
Oh, good. Yes. I do not. No, I have my little apartment.
But you have cooking, so.
I do have cooking. I have baked more than I've ever baked in my life. And sometimes I read the recipes. I'm like, what is this? What does to rise mean? Anyway, I figured it out.
I've been following it on Instagram and everything looks amazing.
Oh, good.
Monte Carlo.
It tastes amazing. Oh, okay. The Monte Carlos didn't work.
But you attempted it, which is more than
I did. I did. You know what's interesting? I always attempt things that are a little bit too hard for me, for my skill level, and then I get really shitty. And then I'm like, just calm down. You attempted it. It's fine. I feel like it's a metaphor for life.
Well, it's a metaphor for writing a book because that is a very hard thing to do. And yet we still try.
We still do try. It was interesting. I was talking. I think I've spoken to you about this, is where you have an idea for a book or the things that you would like to do, and then you sit down to start doing it, and then it occurs to you that your ideas are further along than your skill level.
Yes.
And it happens to me all the time.
Yeah.
And it's one of those things you think, oh, the thing I wanted to do, that can't happen because I'm not there yet. And it's one of those things where I don't know if you feel the same way, but I think, to get there, I have to do this first. And so every single project or book that you do, that leads you to the next thing. And so you can only be where you are, I guess, is what I'm trying to say.
Absolutely. Because right now I decided that I would write a middle grade fiction book about a dingo. And it's not that I thought it would be easy, but I thought, well, I know a lot about this story. It's a great story. It's a true story about this dingo that was taken by an eagle and fell out of the sky and landed in someone's backyard. As a pup, it turns out to be this very rare alpine dingo that's going to save its species if we have anything to do with it. And yeah, I started and realized, like, oh, yeah, I don't know how to write a middle grade fiction book. And the more I read and them, the more I realize, I'm not capable of this. They are amazing. And my high hopes at the start have turned into me going, oh, my God, what am I doing?
Don't you think, though, that it's good to do something that you have no idea what you're doing?
It is. It is good, except I just am doing a puzzle instead because it's got to be hard.
It is really hard. It's funny you should say that there must be something in the air because I have started writing a series for middle grade with a friend. And it's one of those things where, I don't know, it's really fun to do, but I also do realize, oh, this is because the other thing I find really difficult and so I need another outlet. And it's fun to do. And I feel really rejuvenated about the whole process. But then there is a thing that goes, I don't know how to do this, because it's reading it is one thing,
yeah,
but to actually do it yourself is another. I think it's a completely different skill set.
It is. And I also, having, I've got a 10-year-old niece who is a incredible reader, and her reviews are harsh of books. Like, even if she likes them, it is a full review of, like, you know, the author let the ball drop here. And I was really disappointed, and I just hope she does better in the second, installment. And so I know that these readers are very smart.
They really are. What were you like as a reader when you were that age?
I loved being read to, but I was a slow reader, so I struggled. I was a remedial English student for my whole schooling. So... I'm a terrible speller. My grammar was terrible. My handwriting is terrible. My brother's the same. And so reading for us was a struggle, but we love stories. So we would listen to audio books. Back then they were on cassette or on the ABC on Sundays with the radio plays. So I loved stories, and I knew I wanted to be in stories and around stories, but I struggled with reading. So it wasn't until sort of year 12 that I really started to read a lot.
Mm.
What about you?
What about me? I read a lot as a kid, but I think, I don't know, I'm just trying to think now what I... So it's interesting because my mum and dad never finished high school.
Yes.
And which I think is, I think they had maybe year 10 and then they kind of dropped out and, you know, worked. Yes. My mum and dad were also 19 and 20 years old when they had me.
Look, this is so similar to me. I mean, that's like exactly the same as me.
Yeah. That's so strange. I didn't know this about you. What? Maybe we just have never spoken about how we were conceived. I don't know. But it's interesting. My biggest memories of reading is books were always in the house, but I don't think we could really afford them. I just know they were there, and they would come from the library. And my dad was in particular, was a huge reader, and he'd spend weekends on the couch just reading and reading and reading. And so I think I got it from just watching other people read. So I knew it was good. And I liked stories and I liked making stories up. My brother and I were encouraged a lot to just make up stories. And then I would write them myself. But I don't know. I read a lot, but I wasn't. When you talk to some of your other friends and you talk about reading habits and then they just tell you everything they ever read, and I just think, oh, God, yeah, I wasn't like you. I just read a lot, what I thought was a lot, but I never was reading, Anna Karenina at the age of 11 or something.
My favourite book was Wind in the Willows, so, I mean, there you go.
That's so beautiful.
Yeah, but I never got onto the Judy Blume, like, fad or the, what was the other one, Babysitting Club or something. There was some American high school thing as well. And
Sweet Valley High,
that's it.
Amazing.
You know, they were popular, I couldn't afford to buy books. So they weren't the books that you could get at the secondhand shop.
Yeah.
So the books that I could get at the secondhand shop in high school were all the classics and, you know, all the old Penguin that are just the orange covers. So I read a lot of the classics because I could afford to buy one book a week at the secondhand shop.
Yeah. It's so interesting. We would do that, but also I would save up my money and I would go and buy the Babysitter's Club books. But my favourite ones to buy were the super specials because they were super thick. Oh. And so every Friday my mum and dad would take me down to the shops and I would buy one. And I would, you know, all that and also, you know, like the R.L. Stein and Christopher Pike.
Yes.
All those books. I would maybe try to get one or two of those and then I would come back and I just read them way, way too quickly.
That's what you wanted to buy. Like, that's the same with my nephew. Yeah. I'm like, what do you want to do? And they like go to the bookshop and they've already got a list of like what they want. It's fantastic.
My daughter's the same. Yeah, she's 8 and I can't keep up with her reading. She's, a ferocious reader. She is one of those as well, but she's voracious. But it's just so interesting how you come to stories because I think the thing that really hooked me into telling stories did I say reading or writing, Fable? I don't know.
I think you said writing.
I meant reading, but then writing was because I did start making up my own stories. So I think my first story that I clearly remember and was a story about, I think I was in grade 1, and it was about Helen Keller, who I was obsessed with, and a ghost. And then not at all. And I just wrote about that like all the time. And there was another story I think my mum and dad had to come up to school for because I wrote this story in grade 1 about a murder and there was some stabbing that happened. My teacher said, well, you know, we just want to encourage as much imagination as possible, but is Sarah okay? And they're like, yeah, she's fine. That's just what she's like. So I think knowing that maybe that was my first audience that didn't like what I was doing, but knowing though that you could have an impact on somebody, I think was actually really encouraging. And I just kept wanting to do that.
That's great. My stories in like year 10 and 11 were all very serious environmental very deep and like things like whales were beaching themselves to try and give us a message that, you know, we had only a limited time to save the world, that kind of thing. So I was very serious writer, earnest, and I guess that writing was my way of like, I want to change the world. I'm not like that anymore, but I was a very passionate teenager.
You don't think you're like that anymore?
Well, I mean, I'm not trying to change the world with my writing. I am trying to make people feel, I think.
Yeah.
Which is important. So.
Oh, absolutely.
It's a much smaller goal. You know, saving the world is a big goal, but making people feel is probably the first step to that. So.
It is. Do you, just on that, because I think that's really interesting that we come to stories or the things that we want to, there's on the one hand, I think there's a thing that we do because we want to write that story. But then I guess there's another goal as well. And I know for myself, it's like when I write, I want someone to feel completely caged in, or I want them to feel viscerally unwell, or I want you to be upset. And I guess, or maybe love one day, who knows? Are you writing with that intent as well, or is it the story first? And then it's like, oh, and also I would like you to laugh.
All I know is it's never that intentional, but I do understand that if I feel something intensely, then the reader will feel it. So I am aware of that. So I am aware that, like, I really do want to make this person who's reading my book love this grandma or love this boy or want to cook chicken schnitzel, or I am aware of that. But I guess it's not what I set out to do. What I set out to do is just be completely taken by this story and it be 100% of my brain and heart and just be in it. And but I know now that, like, readers, if you do that, then readers will feel something.
Mm. Do you find it really hard to come out of the novel for everyday life?
Very hard. And especially, you know, once you get a fair bit into it, reality is a strange thing because you're half in the book, half in the normal world. And it's the time, especially towards the end of my writing, I like lock myself out of the house, I forget things, I'm totally in the novel. And that's when amazing things happen. That's when you start dreaming solutions to the problems in your writing. You start seeing things, like messages come to you basically at that point because you're so 100% fixated on your story that it's everything. And that's a magical thing when that happens. But it is hard because the people in your life that are in the normal world sort of have to deal with you being absent.
Absence, I think, is something I'm quite good at, but also it's bad. Because I feel exactly the same thing. I'm never 100% anywhere at any time because I think, I don't know, I always, and I've always felt this, but particularly with the new novel that I'm writing as well, I don't know, I feel the same that my heart is 100% to the novel.
Yes.
And I obviously, because I'm raising my daughter and stuff, obviously I've got that too, but you can never switch that off.
No.
And I find it really hard, as exactly how you're saying, the further you go along with something, the more I just am quite consumed
and
by the story.
And it's such a full-on thing that when you do come out of it and your book's out and then you're back in the world and you're touring and then you're at home again, it is really quite frightening to make that decision to go back into another book, like to go away from the world and away from your friends and away from everything again and for 5 years or however long it's going to be. So it's a scary thing. And for a long time after this novel, I'm like, I don't want to go back down. I want to stay in this world for a bit.
It's one of those things I'm really trying, and I have been for the last couple of years in particular, really trying very, very hard to be more present than I have ever been because I know what I'm like. Yeah. And I, if I didn't have family or anything like that, I could very well just go and live in a hole.
I understand.
Somewhere. Yeah. And just be in that imagination and then just kind of, I was going to say bang them out fable, but I can't, it takes me such a long time to write. But it's so easy to slip into that magical thinking.
I know.
And I think that's what it was like as a child where I would spend so much of my time, if it wasn't playing with my brother, making up things with him, it was always just in my room, just making up these stories and also trying to figure out how other people might live and what it is like to be somebody else. And it's like play acting, I guess. And so you always know who you are, or I feel like I've always known who I am. But then there are these other little moments and parts of you that can come out. And I feel like that's the way, you know, your characters kind of become. And everyone says, you know, a lot of writers and even my publisher will say, you know, you're in control of this. Your characters aren't, and I understand that. And I, on the one hand, I think like that and I agree, but there's this other part that just, for me anyway, and it sounds like it's for you, if I'm not able to come into that magical realm, then I just can't write.
Look, I think they're wrong actually, Sarah, and I know what they're saying because they are in a different world of publishing. They're in the business side of it and putting the book together and marketing and putting it out. However, the characters are in control. If you make them do something that you want, it's false. It reads badly. Mm. It reads fake. And often when I read a book and something's not right and I can't read anymore because something's annoying me, it's that. It's that the author has, directed the characters to please the audience or something. And I don't believe that that's how I write. I don't think it's how you write. My characters come and they lead me with their energy, and it's often surprising, but it's wonderful. And if I did know everything, we wouldn't do it, because what's the point?
Yeah.
One thing I'd like to say too is, when I was young, everybody used to – I used to get in trouble all the time for daydreaming, and, you know, that it was the biggest waste of time, that all I ever did was daydream. But when you think about what daydreaming is, it is imagination. You're imagining whole worlds. You're imagining whole scenarios. So I would sit on the swing or whatever and daydream for hours, and I had whole worlds going. And it turns out that that's been, you know, that's the most valuable skill that I have as a writer.
I think it's also, again, just like you, forever daydreaming, still do it.
Oh, same, because daydreaming is manifesting.
It is. Yes. And it's also, it is a form of problem solving. It and is. I think it's so interesting and actually quite valuable to be able to sit in a space long enough to let those things, because I think for writing, for some people, and maybe why a lot of people maybe give up or they don't kind of pursue a story, or I don't know, there could be many reasons, but sometimes it's really confronting to sit in the world that you've created and then see it out.
Really?
And so being able to daydream or to sit and do it, I think, yeah, I agree. I think it's a gift to be able to do it, but also it's good training.
It is. And the other thing is, I never get bored. Like, I don't really understand what bored is. I can, like,
me neither.
Yeah, because I can just, like, sit and go into imagination really easily and daydream. It's how I fall asleep. When I wake up, I like to just lie in bed for ages because I just want to stay in this sort of daydreaming. Often that's when a lot of like good stuff is coming up, and you know, it's great. I'd like, give me like 5 days on my own, I'm fine.
I have to say, I feel the same too. I don't understand what being bored is, because I just like, there is so much to do. But I think there's so many things to think about in a constructive way. But it's also just that consuming, you know, I'm forever dreaming every single night about my work. And that's how I start everything. As well, that it's always an image or a feeling that has come to me at nighttime.
I love that.
And so you use that to explore what that actually means. And then, you know, 3 to 5 years later, you have a thing. But the I have to say, like with this book, and I don't, I guess, I mean, I don't know. I don't think it makes me seem weird, but, and I've spoken to my therapist about this because it's something that I've had to do, because this book is quite personal to me, and it's brought up a whole bunch of things. But I started, there's one particular character that I've got, and he's one of the most violent people I've ever written. And when I first started thinking about him, he came to me at night all the time, and I would see him, you know, standing in my doorways. And I've always felt that I've seen this particular character all the time throughout my life, but just never really known who he is. And so last year in particular, like, I would see him every night, and he was just getting bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. And it, to the point like where I would be completely frozen with fear, because I'm thinking, there he is, he's coming towards me. He's got these kind of things. So I had to tell my therapist, and I said, am I literally losing my mind? Because this hasn't really happened to this level before. And I started to feel like I'd gone too far. And she basically said, do you know you're dreaming when you're doing it? And I say, yes, I know he's not really there, but I see him. And she basically said it was trauma, that these manifestations that you see a lot, one thing that they could be is trauma. Yeah. And so the more that you don't confront something, or the more that, and I felt like when I was writing him, I was actually confronting a few things.
Yeah.
And so maybe I think what it was just this manifestation of this world that I was building for myself to be able to express whatever it is that he symbolized. And what's been really interesting, as soon as I kind of figured that out, and the more I just kind of wrote those really horrible scenes or just kind of exercised them out of myself, I guess, he has disappeared. I barely see him. And it's taken a year. It's not something that goes away overnight. But I guess the point for me, though, is, you know, before I was writing this particular book, I would just see this person in and out of my life for ages, and I had no way to deal with it. But I think through writing, that is the way to deal with these
things. Absolutely. And it's proof that our unconscious is doing a lot of the load, a lot of the work.
Mm.
So if you allow that to happen, like let it happen, your unconscious has already got the book done for you in a way, and it's feeding you the bits that you need to know when you need to know them in a lesser scary way. And it's not trauma, but when I was writing When the Night Comes about Nella Dan, I dreamt about her every night and I would wake up bawling, like, because in my dream she was back and not sunk. And for that brief 5 minutes of like waking up, I believed she was still here and I was so excited. Yeah. And then I would go, oh, I'm awake. Oh, she's gone. And it was so full on, but I know, and this is going to sound like I'm crazy. But okay. She came to me because she'd been forgotten down there in the dark, and there were a lot of sailors that needed to get together and heal, because there's a lot of, you know, these people who were on her have held on to pain for 25 years. And I just know that's why, and she doesn't come to me anymore, and I miss that. But it's like I did what she wanted, and I got the story out, and all these other people have taken up the cause and are all talking and having reunions, and she's back, and people are remembering her, and now she doesn't visit me anymore at night, which I sometimes miss. But it's funny.
I completely understand that missing. I miss people that are real but aren't real at the same time, because you just get so used to them. But I think maybe it sounds like what you're saying is you did your job to try to kind of connect, I guess, kind of the missing links of that, you know, those, I guess, the border town between truth and fiction.
Yeah.
And by even summoning up those kind of specters, really, what you're doing is just unleashing something else for someone, for other people to, I guess, take ownership over, it sounds like.
Yeah.
So she's left you, but she's gone to somewhere else where she should be.
Absolutely. And with you too, if you weren't frightened or at least a bit alarmed by this guy, you wouldn't be able to write him properly. Like, it's, you know, it would be a caricature or a two-dimensional character, but because you actually, oh my God, this guy, I'm a bit frightened, like it's full on. So you already feel that intensely, so when you're writing him, that's going to come through for the reader and on the page. That's gold.
It's,
even though it might drive you insane and terrify you.
It's interesting because when I got the idea for this book, it was a dream. And then because it takes me such a long time to figure out what it is that I want to write and all that stuff. But one of the things that I kind of explicitly felt I wanted to do, and I think it's getting older as well, I don't have time to be coy anymore. I don't want to do that. And so when I was thinking about all the possibilities that this book could do, and when the story kind of presented itself, it was an interesting thing because on the one hand, I thought, this is exactly what's going to happen. I can see it. There's no equivocating about anything. And yet at the same time, I'm like, I don't want to write this because I don't want to write this book that is ultimately, I think, in some ways, super brutal, very violent, very sad and bleak.
Yeah.
Like, I have nothing nice to say about things. But at the same time, I don't want to be coy. Why don't we just say the things we want to say? And I think in books, let's just say the things you want to say. Obviously, there's things I don't think you should say. I don't think you should be a complete asswipe or racist or whatever. But I think that kind of when we come to about feelings, I guess, that, you know, there's all these things. And because I think, I don't know, I want to be honest on the page and I want to be honest in real life. And if that means I have to, you know, some of the things that you say are frightening and
yes.
for all different reasons. And I just think, I don't know where I'm going with
well,
this.
Can you imagine if you suppressed it and said, no, I'm not going to write this? It wouldn't just go away in you. There'd be a conflict there. So it's, if the energy's there and it's urgent, it's got to, you've got to, I think you can't turn your back on it. I think,
no.
It, as much as it might be painful, you're worried that what people will think, it's readers will think or whatever, it's if it's coming and it's urgent, it's a gift, really, and it's, you've just got to do it. I don't know. I trust that now, you know, after 3 books now, that is the thing about my process that I absolutely trust. If yeah. it's urgent and it's coming up in my dreams, in my writing, it's, you know, past the shallows, I didn't want to write about Tasmania, the South. I didn't want to ever go there again, and I still haven't been to the yeah. South. But it just kept coming, and it was so annoying. I was like, I don't want to be here. I don't want to write this. And in the end, I had to surrender because it was just coming. It was coming whether I liked it or not. It was a massive wave. And thank God I followed it. And it was painful. It was not an easy yeah. story to write. It was painful being back there in that place. And a place that I am terrified of. So, but I had to do it. And it took me 5+ years of being in that place to write a very small book that, if I hadn't given in and just done it, God knows, I wouldn't have ever written anything.
I can hear that in your voice because, you know, when we've spoken about this before, particularly with There Was Still Love, like, I don't know, I feel when you talk about these types of things, it's such a visceral thing. Like, I can see, I can picture it now, but every time I talk to you about this stuff, like your skin goose bumps yeah. and all that kind of stuff. And I think it's one of those things about the not turning away from something. And I think particularly now, I think there's, you know, so many different things going on in the world and I don't know, and people going through their own personal things. I always think just that sitting in the thing that is so uncomfortable.
Oh, man.
And trying to figure out why I'm like this. You know, when you're talking about Past the Shallows and the thing that you didn't want to go and do, and yet you went and did it. And I always think, you know, in that Favel back then,
yep.
what did future Favel know that she didn't?
Look,
and yeah. and just knew that you have to come and sit through this yes. and it's going to be so uncomfortable, but you need to do it.
I know. With no guarantees of, like, you know, I was no one. I didn't have a publishing deal. It was, you know, but I still had to do it. Like, it was coming. Mm-hmm. And there are some days at the writing desk, especially with this last book, where I, like, it's literally wanted to, like scratch my skin off. Like, you're just sitting there feeling so wretched is the word, and you just want to run out of the office, out of the studio, run, do anything. And to sit there in that uncomfortable feeling is so awful. It's just the hardest thing. But I know when I feel like that, something raw is coming up and it's yeah. making me feel uncomfortable and I want to turn away, I want to dull it down, I want to watch Netflix, I want to do anything. But if I sit there, I might not write a lot, but something very important is coming. So it might be 2 words. It might be just, I've just got this, a vision of something or an idea. If I sit through that, I know that's where the gold is that's going to crack mm-hmm. open the story. So, you know, you do that once a week at least and it's awful. You do it for years and and the payoff is that you might go, oh, my God, I think there's something okay here. that's as good as it gets. Like a good day is like, oh my God, I think this is holding. I think that this might work if I keep going. You don't, you never get this like, oh my God, this is so fantastic. I've written a great book and it's all going so well. But those moments in your chest where you feel like, I think I've cracked something here. I think I've worked something out.
Yeah. That's really special to do. Over the summer, I was kind of trying to finish off a big section of my manuscript, and it had been something that I had been putting off since the very beginning, because I knew exactly how this book would end.
Right. Well, that's good.
I knew. Yeah.
It's good. You didn't want normally, to write it. Yeah.
But I didn't want to write it, and I knew exactly how it started, and I knew how it ended. Wow. And so for a long time, I didn't have that ending. And so I thought, I have to go and sit down and write it. And every single day, I just couldn't do it. And then this one particular day, I mean, I would write things, but it wasn't good because I was holding back. Yes. And again, I was being coy. And then I just thought, oh, fuck this. I'm just going to just do the thing, because I knew what was about to come out, and I knew what I would be letting go personally, letting go. Yes. And I reckon this one particular day, I wrote, I don't even know how long it went for, but by the end of it, I had no energy, but also I just sobbed the entire time. And I physically hurt. Mm. And it was just interesting because I'm thinking about now, I don't know what to say about it except for I was an utter wreck. And I had to call a friend to kind of get her to talk me off the ledge, not because I was going to hurt myself or anything. It wasn't anything like that, but I was just in
so
this very horrible, weird kind of state. Anyway, I went to sleep and it was the first peaceful night's sleep I'd had for such a long time. And then the next day I read over what I wrote. Now, look, half of it was shit. There was nothing. But I could see that there was a particular kind of energy and an emotional truth that I wanted to get to. And so the thing that is left over will hopefully be in the finished product. There's a whole bunch of it that won't get there. But I guess the point is, like, the most awful thing to do is sometimes is just to confront those things. But I think... and it might not be sad for other people to read, but for me, it was just, I just did not want to go there, and I went there, and who knows if
I'm... But I think it will be sad for other people because you went there 100%. So they'll feel something because you went there 100%. And the other thing I'd like to say is all raw drafts, half of it is crap, but what is important about the raw draft, and I call the raw draft that first... really 100%, you're there 100%, but it's your first draft in that it's just this raw pouring out of stuff. So there's, for me, there's a lot of repetition. There's a lot of, stuff that can go later. But what is in there is that raw emotional truth, and that is everything. So after that, then, of course, you draft it down, but what you keep is the emotional truth. So that raw draft is the hardest one, and it's the one that you have to be 100% present for, and it's the one that half of it is crap and you'll get rid of it. But, in there is that raw emotional gold that you've put yourself in there 100%. And that's bloody hard to do.
It really is.
You can't
is.
Do it every day. It really is. That's why some days I go, okay, I can't do a raw thing today. I'm going to work on this bit and draft a second draft, third draft, fourth draft. And that's what I'm going to do today. Tomorrow maybe I'll face another raw bit section.
Yeah. It's really, there's so many things that are coming out. It's like all these, if I had hours of to talk to you about, I would just sit here and pour my little soul out. I know. But it's so, one of the things that I find interesting, because I always call those raw drafts draft zero.
Oh, I love that.
Because Yeah, because anything goes, right? So you just kind of get it down. And I write little notes to myself. Now, sure, are those notes mostly, Sarah, you're an idiot, why are you doing this? Yes, but I just write them down because I do like to talk to myself, because there's another part of me that will say to that self, shut up, you don't know what you're talking about. I'm going to trust the process. But it's so interesting because it's through those, I don't know if you ever feel like this, but sometimes I think, or the fear is, this is the last thing I'll ever write. I've got nothing left. What else am I possibly going to say? What other characters am I going to have? And every single time I think that, it's partly why I started doing improv comedy, because I was so afraid. That's a completely different other conversation.
I love that you do that, though.
Oh, I do too. I'm not good at it, but I like it.
But I think it's something very hard. I think it's really amazing.
Yeah, but I guess the lesson from that is that I really love about it. And I guess it's a form, like in meditation as well, things come and go. You will always have, there is always another idea, and they just exist out in the ether. They don't always come from you. They're just there. The point is you have to listen to them. And so when I'm doing that draft zero, the next book almost always presents itself, whether it's thematically or there's a character or something, go, oh, I love that, but it's not for
the
this
right
book.
Time.
And then you just kind of, yeah. And so I think that's the thing I love about that kind of primal way of starting something from the very beginning, because everything else comes from that. And so I feel like if you were to look at, as particularly your work and stuff, if you were to look at the progress of someone's career and you see, you know, and you can be doing different things and in different genres or whatever, but I kind of feel like there's this beautiful chronology of a writer figuring out their next ideas and, you know, the path that they've wanted to go down. And in some ways, I guess maybe we do just write the same things over and over again and package it differently, but
and that's okay. And look, my favorite author, Per Pedersen, says he writes the same thing over and over, and I could read them all forever, over and over and over till the end of time and never be bored. I'd like to say that after Past the Shallows, I thought I'd never be able to write another book, or I wouldn't feel as passionate about another book. And it took a while. And then you're in When the Night Comes, and I felt incredibly passionate, so passionate I went to Antarctica. I became a sailor. I went to Denmark. I did all this stuff. And then that was over, and I thought, I'm never going to feel that passion. And then a couple of years later, I'm in again, and I feel even more passion than ever before. So you're right. It is going to be never ending if we're open to sitting there with those uncomfortable feelings in the room.
Yeah, it's almost because I don't know if you do this too, but I mean, I look at what other people are writing and I think, oh God, I can't do that. They're geniuses. And then I think we all do our own thing anyway. Maybe we're not all meant to be writing the same things anyway, but
it's so hard.
I just, when you compare yourself, and I can say this both rationally and also whatever, and it doesn't mean that I feel the same. it depends what mood I'm in, but I just think the more you compare yourself and the more that you, I guess, criticize the things that come out of you and you second guess, I think the more closed you are both as a writer and a human.
Yes.
And you're actually, and I think you kind of tell yourself, and actually you're telling ideas, don't come to me because I'm not going to treat you with respect.
Yes. Yeah.
And so you go to someone else.
It's so hard not to compare yourself, especially when we make no money, and you might there might be some writer you know who's just got a $1 million deal or something, and you sometimes inside you go, well, why can't my book be made into a film, or why can't I do this? But I learned from some other writers that I know who are very generous that there's no point comparing yourself to anyone else. We all do different things. We're all part of this big movement, though, together. And by comparing yourself, you're sort of lessening the whole. So we all contribute a little tile to the mosaic or whatever, you know. That's a stupid way of putting it, but
no, it's perfect.
But if you judge yourself against other people, you're sort of smashing the whole thing down. So writers, one thing that I didn't know before I was published, are so generous with each other. And
they
just,
really are.
You know, we're the only people that understand the crazy thing we do, because publishers don't understand, friends don't understand, families don't understand exactly, but other writers do. They get it. So we can talk to each other and we can bitch and moan and complain. We can be each other's union. We can give each other courage. And writers do that daily for me, you know, in little ways. And I'm just, it's overwhelming. The support. Generally, there's just a ton of love and support between writers, and that goes for other artists as well. So I'm trying very hard daily to not compare myself to other writers, which is hard.
It is hard. I do it all the time, and then I get cross on myself for doing it. And it's not and I guess I think the thing that is important to kind of say, and I don't know, who knows how other people feel, but I think there's a difference of comparing yourself and then being jealous of that. And I think never be jealous, because, A, that's not helpful. But also, why, I don't know, I just think it's when you're jealous, you're not supportive.
Yeah.
And I think the point of all art or anything, actually just living as a human being on this freaking earth, if you don't cooperate, if you don't help other people, if you don't sit there and listen or, I don't know, offer advice or just be supportive, I don't know, it doesn't work. And I think, I don't know, I just don't think you make good work if you're jealous or
you don't want to support other people. From that ambition of jealousy to be better, then I don't think you're going to write anything that is meaningful or great. I don't know. But that's just my opinion. It is easy to fall into that, you know, like comparing yourself. But we've just got to not do that. We've just got to instead look at how many amazing writers we have in this country kicking goals. Like just – and look at the diversity. It's just insane. It's so good. It's such a strong we have such a strong culture here.
We really do. And I think, you know, the thing that I love about so many people and my friends and other people I read who I don't know personally, whatever, is that for me, not that jealousy, it's the worst. It's the comparativeness is like, I'll just use you as an example.
Yeah.
I always go, here's this woman who's got this amazing story. This is the way that she's chosen to tell it. And there's a part of me goes, I just, as a, from a technical side, it would always be, how did she do that? My brain doesn't work like that. I wish I could write like that. And then, you know, and then you read the next person and then you go, oh, I wish I could. And so I guess the point is, you can't wish that you were somebody else. You can learn from them. You can kind of take that on board and appreciate what they do and maybe learn a few tricks from that. But I guess at the end of the day, again, you're just maybe you're doing something that someone else wishes they could do.
You are, and just, you especially are. And
oh, I don't think so. I wasn't fishing Fable.
There is no one who can do what you can do, Sarah, and it's amazing what you do. And all we have our voice and it belongs to us and no one else's voice is like ours. And I've got to keep remembering that. I try and remember that every day. So there isn't any comparison.
You tell me that all the time.
So there isn't any comparison because we're all completely unique. Like no one can do what you do. No one can make me smell like vomit for days after I've read a book. Like it's in my nostrils when I read you, or you know, the being in that house when I read your book was so all consuming and just horrific and just claustrophobic, but I couldn't look away. No one can do that.
Well, that was the point, I guess. I wanted you to feel that way. So mission accomplished, yes, I guess. But I don't know. I think, I don't know. I always just think, did I fluke that? I don't know.
No, you didn't.
But then there's a part of me.
Extremely hard.
Yeah, although the only time I'm ever competitive is with myself. And so, and I think, oh, the, you know, your poor project, don't ever be, but like this project, I'm like, you have to be better than the last one. You have to do all these things. And the more I did that, the more I was a nervous wreck. Yeah, I couldn't write.
That's not helpful, but I understand. No, it's not. Second book, I think it's difficult because, and your first book was so brilliant that, you know, you're putting so much pressure on yourself. But it is going to be brilliant, and the bits that I've read are brilliant, and I just can't wait.
Well, thank you. You're so kind, Favour. Every time I feel like I need a G up, I just call you. Oh, boy. Well, I thank you so much, Favour. You're so generous all the time, and I'll speak to you later.
Okay, goodbye. Okay,
bye-bye.
You've been listening to The First Time Podcast. The First Time Podcast is produced by Phoebe 80 and supported by Writers Victoria, the ACT Writers Centre, and our wonderful patrons. This series is supported by the City of Melbourne through a COVID-19 arts grant.